A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's about 7 years out from gallbladder surgery and has been dealing with post-meal bloating that's been, in his words, extremely hard to treat. The go-to approach has been low-dose neuromodulators, things like nortriptyline and amitriptyline, the older antidepressants repurposed at tiny doses. The problem is, they're not selective. Amitriptyline knocked him out so hard, it impaired work the next day. So the question is medicine moving any closer to discovering neuromodulators that can actually be selective for the gut rather than the entire nervous system?
This is one of those questions where the framing itself tells you the problem. Neuromodulators that are selective for the gut, that's the holy grail, and the reason it's been so hard is that the gut and the brain share the same fundamental wiring.
Same neurotransmitter systems.
Exactly the same. Serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, the enteric nervous system uses all of them. There are actually more serotonin receptors in the gut than in the brain. Something like 95% of the body's serotonin is in the GI tract. So when you take a drug that modulates serotonin signaling, you can't just tell it to stay downstairs.
Like trying to direct rain onto one specific plant.
That's actually not a bad analogy. And the older tricyclics like amitriptyline and nortriptyline are especially promiscuous. They hit histamine receptors, muscarinic acetylcholine receptors, alpha-adrenergic receptors. They're basically throwing a pharmacological party and everyone's invited.
The hangover is very real, apparently.
The sedation Daniel's describing is almost certainly from the histamine H1 receptor blockade. Amitriptyline is one of the most potent antihistamines in clinical use. It's actually more sedating than many drugs sold specifically as sleep aids. Nortriptyline is a bit better on that front because it's a secondary amine, less anticholinergic and less antihistaminic, but it's still not selective for the gut.
The core problem is that we're using drugs designed for depression, where crossing the blood-brain barrier is the whole point, and hoping that at 1/10 the dose they'll somehow develop a preference for the intestines.
They don't. They can't. The pharmacokinetics don't work that way. Once a molecule is in the bloodstream, it goes everywhere. The only way to get gut selectivity is to design molecules that can't cross the blood-brain barrier, or that target receptors that are uniquely expressed in the gut, or that are metabolized so rapidly in the liver that they never reach systemic circulation in meaningful amounts.
Let's go through those strategies. Which ones are actually being pursued?
All three, and this is where it gets interesting. There's a whole class of drugs being developed called peripherally restricted, meaning they're designed to stay outside the central nervous system. The blood-brain barrier is the key gatekeeper here. If you can make a molecule that's too large, too polar, or too heavily protein-bound to cross it, you get gut selectivity by default.
This is actually working?
It's working in some areas. The most mature example is actually in opioid receptors. You've got peripherally restricted mu-opioid receptor antagonists like methylnaltrexone and naloxegol. These are used for opioid-induced constipation, and they work exclusively in the gut because they can't get into the brain. They reverse the constipating effects of opioids without reversing pain relief.
Covering the covers.
Right. They're undoing one effect without touching the other. But that's constipation, which is a relatively straightforward motility problem. What Daniel's dealing with, post-cholecystectomy bloating and visceral hypersensitivity, that's a different beast.
Let's define visceral hypersensitivity, because that's really the mechanism we're talking about here.
Visceral hypersensitivity is when the nerves in the gut become overly responsive to normal stimuli, normal distension, normal gas, normal digestion. The nerves fire pain and discomfort, signals at thresholds that shouldn't trigger anything. It's like the volume knob on gut sensation got cranked up and the knob broke off.
Gallbladder removal triggers this how?
It's multifactorial and honestly not fully understood. But the leading theory involves bile acid malabsorption. Without a gallbladder to store and concentrate bile, bile trickles continuously into the small intestine. This can irritate the lining, alter the microbiome, and sensitize the enteric nerves. There's also the possibility of surgical changes to vagal nerve signaling, changes in gut transit time, and alterations in the migrating motor complex. It's a cascade.
The nerves are sensitized, and the traditional approach is to dampen that signaling with neuromodulators. But the drugs we have dampen everything, gut and brain alike.
That brings us to the actual pipeline. There are several approaches being pursued right now. The first and most straightforward is to take existing drugs and make peripherally restricted versions. This is basically what's happening with the newer generation of drugs targeting irritable bowel syndrome.
Give me names.
Okay, so the big one that's actually made it to market in several countries is prucalopride. That's a selective serotonin 4 receptor agonist, and it's primarily for chronic constipation. But the interesting thing is that it has fairly good peripheral selectivity. It crosses the blood-brain barrier poorly. But it's a prokinetic, not a visceral analgesic, so it's not directly addressing the hypersensitivity piece.
Right. Different mechanism entirely.
For visceral hypersensitivity specifically, the most advanced candidate that fits the gut-selective neuromodulator description is probably olorinob. This is a cannabinoid type 2 receptor agonist. CB2 receptors are expressed heavily on immune cells and in the periphery, including the gut, but not in the central nervous system in ways that produce psychoactive effects. CB1 is the one that gets you high. CB2 is the one that modulates inflammation and pain.
It's tapping the endocannabinoid system, but avoiding the part that makes you stare at your own hands for 20 minutes.
Arena Pharmaceuticals developed olorinob, and it went through phase 2 trials for abdominal pain associated with Crohn's disease and IBS. The phase 2 data was, it showed some efficacy signals, particularly in Crohn's-related abdominal pain, but it didn't hit its primary endpoint in the broader IBS pain trial. Arena was acquired by Pfizer in 2022 for about $6.7 billion, largely on the strength of another drug in their pipeline. But olorinab's development has been, let's say, quiet since then.
Quiet as in dead, or quiet as in they're still working on it?
I'm not sure, honestly. Pfizer hasn't made major announcements about it. The clinical trials database shows the phase 2 studies as completed, but no phase 3 registrations. That doesn't necessarily mean it's dead. It could mean they're reformulating, or waiting, or running additional smaller studies. But it hasn't been the home run they were hoping for.
That's the CB2 approach.
The next big category is TRP channel modulators. TRP stands for transient receptor potential. These are ion channels that detect temperature, pain, and chemical irritants. TRPV1 is the one that responds to capsaicin. It's the hot receptor. TRPA1 responds to wasabi and mustard oil. TRPM8 responds to menthol and cold. These channels are expressed on sensory nerve endings throughout the body, including in the gut, and they're heavily implicated in visceral hypersensitivity.
The idea is to block these channels specifically in the gut.
Or desensitize them. There's an interesting paradox with TRPV1. Acute activation causes pain and burning, but prolonged or repeated activation leads to desensitization. That's actually why capsaicin creams work for some types of neuropathic pain. You're essentially exhausting the nerve's ability to signal pain.
Like tiring out a toddler so they'll finally nap.
A very spicy toddler. The challenge with TRP modulators is that these channels are everywhere. Skin, bladder, lungs, you name it. Systemic TRPV1 antagonists cause problems with thermoregulation in clinical trials. People couldn't sense heat properly and were at risk for burns and hyperthermia. So the field has moved toward gut-restricted formulations or compounds that are metabolized so quickly they don't build up systemic exposure.
Are any of these actually in late-stage trials?
There's a compound called tenapanor that's worth mentioning here, though it's not a neuromodulator in the classical sense. It's an inhibitor of the sodium hydrogen exchanger 3, or NHE3, in the gut. It's approved for IBS with constipation. The mechanism is interesting because it reduces sodium absorption in the gut, which increases water retention in the stool and softens it. But it also appears to reduce visceral hypersensitivity through a secondary mechanism involving decreased intestinal permeability. It's peripherally restricted by design. It's minimally absorbed.
It's a gut-selective drug, just not a neuromodulator per se.
But it demonstrates that peripheral restriction is achievable and commercially viable. The FDA approved it, it's on the market, and patients are using it without the systemic side effects you'd get from something that crosses into the brain.
What about the drugs that target serotonin receptors more selectively? We mentioned prucalopride, but that's 5-HT4. What about 5-HT3 antagonists?
5-HT3 antagonists are actually a fascinating case study in this whole problem. Ondansetron, brand name Zofran, is a 5-HT3 antagonist used for nausea and vomiting. It works beautifully for that. It also happens to reduce visceral sensitivity and slow colonic transit, which makes it potentially useful for IBS with diarrhea. There have been multiple trials showing benefit.
It doesn't cause brain fog?
It's generally well tolerated, but here's the thing. Ondansetron does cross the blood-brain barrier. The 5-HT3 receptors in the chemoreceptor trigger zone in the brainstem are exactly where it exerts its anti-nausea effects, so it's not gut-selective at all. But the side effect profile is much cleaner than the tricyclics because it's highly specific for one receptor subtype. It's not hitting histamine receptors, it's not hitting muscarinic receptors, it's not hitting alpha receptors.
Selectivity for a specific receptor subtype can achieve much of what we want, even if the drug does reach the brain, as long as the brain effects of that particular receptor are minimal or tolerable.
And that's a really important point. The problem with amitriptyline isn't just that it reaches the brain, it's that it reaches the brain and binds to half a dozen different receptor types that have nothing to do with gut pain. A drug that reaches the brain but only hits one receptor that's minimally involved in cognition or alertness could be just fine.
What's the most promising gut selective or gut preferential neuromodulator in the pipeline right now, in your assessment?
I think the most interesting candidate that fits the brief most closely is actually a drug called linaclotide. Wait, no, that's already approved, and it's a guanylate cyclase, C agonist. It works locally in the gut lumen and isn't absorbed at all. But it's primarily for constipation, not for visceral hypersensitivity as its primary mechanism, though it does have some analgesic effects through CGMP signaling.
Not quite the answer.
Let me reframe. If I had to point to the approach that I think is most likely to produce a genuinely gut-selective neuromodulator for visceral pain in the next 5 to 10 years, I'd put my money on the peripherally restricted cannabinoid approach, or possibly on a new class of compounds targeting the mass-related G-protein-coupled receptors. These are called MRGPRs, or sometimes MRG receptors.
I've never heard of these.
Most people haven't. They're a relatively recent discovery in the pain field. MRGPRs are a family of receptors expressed primarily on sensory neurons, including those innervating the gut. They were originally identified as receptors that respond to itch stimuli. MRGPRX1, for example, responds to chloroquine and is responsible for the itching side effect of antimalarial drugs. But it turns out these receptors are also involved in pain signaling, and importantly, different members of the family are expressed in different tissues.
You might be able to target one that's gut-specific.
MRGPRX4, for instance, is expressed in the gastrointestinal tract and has been implicated in visceral pain. There's a company called Escient Pharmaceuticals that was working on MRGPR antagonists for various conditions. They were acquired by Incyte in 2024 for about $750 million. The lead programs were for cholestatic pruritus, that's itching caused by bile acid buildup, and for urticaria, which is hives, not gut pain directly.
The receptor family is there, and it's druggable.
It's druggable. And the peripheral restriction is built in because these receptors are primarily on peripheral sensory neurons, not in the central nervous system. The challenge is that the biology is still being worked out. Which specific MRGPR mediates visceral hypersensitivity? Is it the same receptor in different parts of the gut? Are there compensatory mechanisms? It's early stage science, but it's exactly the kind of target that could yield a gut-selective neuromodulator.
We've got CB2 agonists, TRP modulators, MRGPR antagonists, and the general strategy of making peripherally restricted versions of existing drugs. What about the thing Daniel actually asked? Is medicine moving closer? What's the timeline?
I think the honest answer is yes, but slowly and not for the reason most people assume. The bottleneck isn't the science of peripheral restriction. We know how to make molecules that don't cross the blood-brain barrier. The bottleneck is the clinical development pathway. Functional GI disorders, IBS, functional dyspepsia, post-cholecystectomy syndrome, these are not life-threatening conditions. They're quality-of-life conditions. That matters enormously for drug development because the FDA and other regulatory agencies apply a risk-benefit calculus. For a cancer drug, you'll tolerate significant side effects. For a bloating drug, the bar for safety is extremely high.
You need a drug that's not just effective, but essentially side effect free.
And that's expensive to prove. You need large trials, long follow-up periods, and you're competing against cheap generics like amitriptyline that cost pennies per pill. From a pharmaceutical company's perspective, developing a novel gut-selective neuromodulator means spending hundreds of millions of dollars to bring a drug to market that will then compete with a generic that doctors have been prescribing off-label for 40 years.
The economics are terrible.
They're awful. Unless you can demonstrate superiority that's dramatic enough to justify a premium price and convince insurers to cover it. And dramatic superiority in functional GI disorders is hard to demonstrate because the placebo response rate in these conditions is famously high, sometimes 30 to 40%.
40% of people feel better on placebo for IBS.
It's one of the highest placebo response rates in all of medicine. And it's not just subjective reporting, there are physiological changes. The placebo effect in IBS involves real changes in gut motility and brain activation patterns visible on fMRI. It's a robust, measurable phenomenon.
That's both fascinating and deeply inconvenient for drug development.
It's a nightmare for clinical trials. You need very large sample sizes to separate your drug from placebo, and even then, many promising compounds fail at phase 3 because the placebo group does unexpectedly well.
You've got a condition that isn't fatal. A high placebo response rate, a generic competitor that costs nothing, and a regulatory bar that demands near-perfect safety. Why would anyone develop drugs for this?
Because the market is enormous. IBS alone affects something like 10 to 15% of the population in Western countries. The global market for IBS therapeutics was valued at around $2 to $3 billion annually and growing. If you can crack gut-selective neuromodulation, you're looking at a blockbuster.
The incentive is there, but the path is steep.
That's why progress feels slow, but there are things happening. Let me mention a few more specific programs. There's a drug called ibodutant. It's a tachykinin NK2 receptor antagonist. The NK2 receptor is involved in smooth muscle contraction and visceral sensitivity in the gut. Ibodutant was developed by Menarini and actually made it to phase 3 trials for IBS with diarrhea in Europe. It showed efficacy, particularly in women, but the development seems to have stalled. It's peripherally selective. It doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier well.
Stalled? Meaning what?
No new trials registered in the last few years. It's in that pharmaceutical limbo where the data wasn't quite strong enough for approval, but wasn't negative enough to kill the program entirely. Someone might pick it up, or it might sit on a shelf forever.
What about the bile acid piece? Daniel mentioned gallbladder surgery. Is anyone working on drugs that specifically address bile acid malabsorption?
Yes, and this is actually really relevant. Bile acid sequestrants like colestramine and colacevalum have been used off-label for years for post-cholecystectomy diarrhea and bloating. They work by binding bile acids in the gut so they can't irritate the lining. The problem is they're powders or large pills. They're inconvenient. They interfere with absorption of other medications and fat-soluble vitamins, and the bloating can actually get worse in some people because they produce gas.
They fix one problem and create another.
But there's a newer approach, ileal bile acid transporter inhibitors, or IBAT inhibitors. These drugs block the reabsorption of bile acids in the terminal ileum, which you'd think would make things worse. But the idea is that by altering the bile acid pool composition and reducing hepatic bile acid synthesis through feedback mechanisms, you actually reduce the irritant load reaching the colon.
That sounds counterintuitive. Blocking reabsorption to reduce irritation.
It's a feedback loop. When you block the IBAT transporter, less bile acid returns to the liver. The liver senses this and ramps up bile acid synthesis from cholesterol. But the new bile acids are different in composition. And the net effect, at least in theory, is a less irritant bile acid pool. Several IBAT inhibitors have been approved for cholestatic pruritus and for pediatric cholestatic liver diseases. Maralixibat, odevixibat, these are on the market for those indications.
Not for post-cholecystectomy bloating.
There are small studies looking at IBAT inhibitors in bile acid diarrhea and IBS with diarrhea, but nothing specifically for post-cholecystectomy syndrome. It's an area where the science is ahead of the clinical data.
Where does that leave someone like Daniel right now, practically speaking?
There's a clinical algorithm that's worth walking through, because a lot of people, and I see this in the literature all the time, jump straight to neuromodulators without exhausting the mechanical and dietary interventions first.
Start from the beginning.
First thing, after gallbladder surgery with persistent bloating, rule out bile acid malabsorption. There's a test called CHCHCAT, selenium homocholic acid taurine, that measures bile acid retention. If you retain less than 10 to 15% after 7 days, you got significant bile acid malabsorption. The treatment is a bile acid sequestrate, and you start with the lowest possible dose, like a quarter packet of cholestyramine once a day, and titrate up slowly.
Because the side effects are dose dependent.
Because too much will constipate you, which just trades one problem for another. The art is finding the sweet spot. Some people do better with cholecystavelin. It's a tablet rather than a powder, and it tends to cause less bloating than cholestyramine.
What if bile acid malabsorption isn't the issue?
Then you look at small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, SIBO. Post-surgical changes in motility can predispose to SIBO, and SIBO causes bloating that's remarkably similar to what Dango described. Breath testing can diagnose it, and rifaximin, a non-absorbed antibiotic, is the standard treatment.
Non-absorbed meaning it stays in the gut.
Gut selective by design. Rifaximin is fascinating because it's an antibiotic that doesn't get into the bloodstream in meaningful amounts. It works entirely in the gut lumen, and for SIBO and IBS with diarrhea, it's been shown in multiple trials to reduce bloating. The effects can last for weeks to months after a 2-week course, which suggests it's doing something beyond just killing bacteria, possibly modulating the gut immune response or reducing bacterial translocation.
If it's not SIBO either.
Then you look at dietary triggers. Fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols, FODMAPs. A low FODMAP diet reduces fermentable substrate reaching the colon, which reduces gas production. It's not a neuromodulator, but for many people, reducing the stimulus is as effective as dampening the nerve response to the stimulus.
Address the input rather than the processing.
That's the thing. Neuromodulators should be, in my view, fourth or fifth line. You exhaust the mechanical causes, the bacterial overgrowth, the dietary triggers, and then if the nerves are still screaming, you reach for neuromodulation.
When you do reach for it, you're stuck with the same old drugs.
There's a nuance here that doesn't get enough attention, which is that among the existing options, some are much better tolerated than others. If amitriptyline is too sedating, nortriptyline is often better. If nortriptyline is still too much, desipramine is even less sedating. It's the least antihistaminic of the tricyclics. If all tricyclics are intolerable, there are the SSRIs and SNRIs.
Those aren't gut selective either.
No, but the side effect profile is different. Paroxetine has more anticholinergic effects, which can actually be helpful for diarrhea. Predominant symptoms, but can cause cognitive effects. Sertraline and citalopram are cleaner. Duloxetine, an SNRI, has good evidence for pain modulation and is used for fibromyalgia and neuropathic pain. The gut nerves are just another set of sensory nerves.
You're saying the playbook isn't just amitriptyline or nothing.
And there's one more existing option worth mentioning, gabapentinoids. Gabapentin and pregabalin reduce neurotransmitter release by binding to calcium channels. They're used for neuropathic pain, and there's emerging evidence for visceral hypersensitivity. A small randomized trial published a few years ago showed gabapentin significantly reduced rectal hypersensitivity in IBS patients. It doesn't have the anticholinergic or antihistaminic burden of the tricyclics.
It has its own sedation issues.
It does, but the sedation is often more tolerable and tends to diminish over time. And pregabalin is more predictably absorbed than gabapentin, which has this weird saturable absorption where taking more doesn't necessarily increase blood levels linearly.
The practical answer to the question is, there are better tolerated options available right now, even if they're not gut-selective, and the truly gut-selective drugs are probably 5 to 10 years out at best.
I think that's fair. Let me add one more piece that I think is important and often overlooked. There's a whole research domain around what's called local, or topical, neuromodulation, delivering drugs directly to the gut lumen where they act on local nerve endings without significant systemic absorption.
Like a cream for the inside of your intestines.
That's exactly the analogy. There are formulations being explored where you take a drug that would normally be systemic and you engineer it so it's released only in the distal small intestine or colon, acts on the local enteric nerves, and then is either metabolized in the gut wall or excreted without ever reaching meaningful blood levels.
Is anyone actually doing this?
There's preclinical work. The challenge is that the enteric nervous system is embedded in the gut wall, it's not on the luminal surface. So a drug in the lumen has to cross the epithelial barrier to reach the nerves. That's not trivial. But there are approaches using nanoparticles, using permeation enhancers, using prodrugs that are activated by gut enzymes. It's not science fiction, it's just technically difficult.
Probably a decade away from the clinic.
But it's the kind of thing that could completely change the treatment landscape for functional GI disorders. Imagine a pill you take that delivers a local anesthetic, like effect specifically to the nerves in your colon for 8 hours, then clears without ever affecting your brain, your liver, or your kidneys.
That would be the dream. But in the meantime, people are wading through brain fog to turn on the lights.
That's the unacceptable reality. What Daniel described, that trade-off between symptom relief and cognitive function, that's not a real choice. If a treatment makes you unable to work, unable to think, unable to be present with your family, it's not a treatment. It's a different disease.
That's well put.
I think the field is starting to recognize this more explicitly. There was a review in Gastroenterology a couple of years ago that made the case that the primary endpoint for functional GI trials should include cognitive and quality of life measures, not just bowel movement frequency or pain scores. Because a drug that reduces pain but sedates you into dysfunction is not a success.
Has that shifted anything in trial design?
The FDA has been more receptive to patient-reported outcomes in recent years. Things like the IBS Quality of Life Questionnaire are being used as secondary endpoints in trials. But making them primary endpoints is still rare because they're harder to measure and more variable than, say, stool consistency.
The regulatory framework itself is part of the bottleneck.
It's part of it. The other part, honestly, is that functional GI disorders have a branding problem. They're not taken as seriously as they should be. By doctors, by researchers, by funding agencies. Bloating sounds trivial. It's not trivial. It's painful. It's socially disabling. It affects work and relationships and mental health.
The medical equivalent of, it's just a headache.
And the drugs we have reflect that history of dismissal. We've been repurposing antidepressants at low doses, not because it's elegant pharmacology, but because it's what was available and cheap and sort of worked.
The real answer to the prompt is, yes. The science is moving, but the pipeline is thin, the economics are challenging, and the timeline is longer than anyone would like.
I'd add one more thing. The most exciting developments might not come from the traditional pharmaceutical pipeline at all. There's growing interest in what you might call bioelectronic approaches to gut neuromodulation. Instead of using a drug to modulate nerve signaling, you use electrical stimulation. There are implantable devices that stimulate the vagus nerve. Vagal nerve stimulation is already approved for epilepsy and depression. There are also less invasive approaches. Transcutaneous auricular vagus nerve stimulation, where you stimulate a branch of the vagus nerve through the skin of the ear.
You're telling me you can modulate gut function by zapping someone's ear?
The auricular branch of the vagus nerve innervates the concha of the ear. Stimulate it, and you get vagal activation that reaches the gut. There are small studies showing effects on gastric motility, on visceral pain perception, on inflammation. It's early stage, but it's non-pharmacological. It's selective in the sense that you're targeting a specific neural pathway, and it doesn't involve putting drugs into the body at all.
The side effects?
Mostly local. Skin irritation at the electrode site, occasional headache. Nothing like the systemic effects of amitriptyline. The devices are getting smaller and more user-friendly. There's a company called NeurAxis that got FDA clearance for a vagus nerve stimulation device for functional abdominal pain in adolescents. It's not a pill, but it's an option that didn't exist 10 years ago.
That's surprising. I didn't expect the answer to better neuromodulators to be maybe no drugs at all.
The future of neuromodulation might not be chemical. Or it might be a combination, a gut-selective drug for baseline maintenance, plus a device for acute flares. We're moving toward personalized approaches where you match the intervention to the mechanism in that specific patient.
Which brings us back to Daniel's situation. Post-cholecystectomy bloating that's resistant to standard treatments. If you were his doctor, and you were a pediatrician, so this is entirely hypothetical, what would your next step be?
I'd want to know what's been ruled out already. Has he had a CH CAT scan? Has he had a breath test for SIBO? Has he done a systematic FODMAP elimination and rechallenge under a dietitian's guidance? Because if the answer to any of those is no, there's still low-hanging fruit. If all of that's been done and the nerves are the problem, I'd try nortriptyline starting at 10 milligrams at bedtime, 10, not 25, and titrate up by 10 milligrams every 2 weeks until there's benefit or side effects become limiting.
10 milligrams is tiny.
For depression, the therapeutic dose of nortriptyline is 75 to 150 milligrams. For visceral hypersensitivity, you start at 10. The dose response curve is completely different. And if nortriptyline is still too sedating, I'd switch to disipramine or consider gabapentin at a low dose. The key is to go low and go slow. The effective dose for gut pain is often a fraction of what's used for mood disorders.
What about the gut selective stuff? Should he be asking his gastroenterologist about clinical trials?
It's not unreasonable. GOV is searchable by condition and location. There are often phase 2 and 3 trials recruiting for IBS and functional dyspepsia. Some of those may include post-cholecystectomy patients. The eligibility criteria will specify, but I'd caution that most trials exclude people who've tried multiple neuromodulators already because they want a clean population.
The system is set up to study the easiest cases, not the hardest.
That's a problem across all of medicine, not just GI. Clinical trials are designed to show efficacy, not to reflect the messy reality of actual patients who failed 3 treatments and have overlapping conditions.
We should probably wrap this up, but I want to circle back to the core question one more time. Is medicine moving closer to gut-selective neuromodulators? Give me your honest one-sentence answer.
Yes, but the distance between closer and here is measured in years, not months, and the drugs that eventually arrive will probably target receptors we've barely characterized yet. The MRGPRs, the peripheral cannabinoid system, or something we haven't even named.
In the meantime, it's about smarter use of what we have, exhausting the non-pharmacological options, and advocating for a field that still doesn't get the respect it deserves.
If you're a patient, document everything. Track symptoms, track triggers, track responses to every intervention. The data you bring to your doctor is often more valuable than anything in their textbook.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Penrose tiling, a pattern that covers a plane without repeating, was widely attributed to Roger Penrose in the 1970s. But in 1938, a Japanese mathematician named Shiko Nakamura, stationed on the Kuril Islands with the Imperial Japanese Navy, described an identical aperiodic tiling in a letter to his mentor. The letter was rediscovered in a Kyoto archive in 2002.
Of course it was in a Kyoto archive.
The Kuril Islands, of all places.
So here's the forward-looking thought I want to leave listeners with. The gut has its own brain, the enteric nervous system with hundreds of millions of neurons. We've known this for decades, but we're still treating it like an appendage of the central nervous system rather than a target in its own right. The day we start designing drugs for the gut's brain, rather than borrowing drugs from the head's brain, is the day this whole field changes. I think that day is coming. It's just taking its time.
Like a certain sloth, I know.
Don't start.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com.
Or on Spotify, where we have 200 episodes of exactly this kind of thing.
I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be here.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts,
time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.